Welcome to Still Scared, Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray, and today we're going to be talking about the 1988 film Beetlejuice, directed by Tim Burton. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good evening.
Hoi hoi.
So this topic was a last minute choice because my William Sleater books have taken a long time to get to me. So I'm sure it will arrive before our next one, but not in time for this one. So yeah, Beetlejuice might not be an obvious choice for children's horror?
I was thinking about this, but then it's not really an obvious choice for adult horror either.
No, it's a sort of middle.
It's one of those curious 80s films, and the 80s seem to do this in particular, where you really don't know who the target audience was.
Yeah.
Which is somewhat of the charm of early Burton films, I think, that they're very odd.
Yeah.
But also tonally, it's slightly queasy. There are some weird mismatches in the tone of it. Is Beetlejuice meant to be just a kind of zany villain, or is he meant to be genuinely, you know, a figure of horror? It's quite hard to tell.
Yeah.
I guess I consider it kids' horror because I probably watched it as a kid, or it's the kind of film I remember being around when I was a kid, or certainly Burton generally, I associate with my younger teenage years and people liking Burton.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. I think I watched it as a teenager.
What are your childhood or teenage memories of Burton?
I think mostly me being contrary and not being into Burton because I didn't want to, because it seemed like there were lots of sort of teenage goths who were really into it, and I was just being like, oh no, that's, I'm not like that. So yeah, just being contrary really. I'm sure I did watch Beetlejuice and I did watch Nightmare Before Christmas, but I was not much of a enthusiast, I guess.
See, I really liked Nightmare Before Christmas as a little kid, but definitely pre-teenage. Like, not that long after it came out, I think. So I remember going round to a friend's house who lived at the other end of the village, and he had it on video, and we watched it. And I really liked it up till the Oogie Boogie's lair. I couldn't cope with when Oogie Boogie, who for the minimal amount of listeners who haven't ever seen Nightmare Before Christmas, is basically a kind of sackcloth ghoul. So he's quite a sort of big figure, and he's made up of bugs, basically. So he's a sort of a semblance of bugs with a white cloth thrown over him. And at the end of the film, he's unravelled. So Jack or Sally gets part of his thread and sort of unstitches him, and he falls to pieces and he goes, "My bugs!" And as he falls apart, his voice splits into the increasingly high-pitched and diminishing voices of the assemblance of bugs as they scatter. So, "My bugs! My bugs! My bugs! My bugs!" I found that incredibly disturbing. And I still think it is very disturbing. Because where is his consciousness situated? You don't know. Like, I guess he's just meant to be a hive mind or something.
Yeah. It's similar to in Coraline, isn't it? The man upstairs who's made of rats.
Oh, yes, the other Mr. Babinski. Yeah, and Coraline says, like, oh, you don't understand. You're not even... Yeah, you're just a copy she made of the real Mr. Babinski. It's not even that anymore. And then sort of falls apart into rats. So, yeah, I wonder if that's more of a Henry Selick thing than a Tim Burton thing, maybe.
Should I give a little summary of Beetlejuice?
Yeah, I think it can be a little summary.
Adam and Barbara are a young married couple who die at the beginning of the film and find themselves as ghosts, confined to the boundaries of their house with only a handbook of the recently deceased for guidance. When a new family moves in and they find their home being transformed by the obnoxious Delia, they decide to get the Dietzes out by any means possible. The bureaucracy of the afterlife is no help, and their attempts at haunting only succeed in getting the interest of the teenage daughter, Lydia, and her sympathy. So instead they turn to a seedy-looking rogue bioexorcist called Beetlejuice, who claims he can get the new inhabitants out for good. And that's my sort of unspoilery summary.
Well, I guess the spoiler is, and things go awry.
And things go wrong, yes.
So what did you like about Beetlejuice?
Okay, I enjoyed all the playing with scale, the kind of borrowers type things, because the character Adam has a scale model of the town that he keeps in the attic. And when they summon Beetlejuice, he's inhabiting this model, and the Maitlands have to go into it and dig him out of his grave. But they're sort of digging through the kind of squares of plastic astroturf and cork and...
Oh, that was totally... That was the best bit, absolutely.
It was actually really great, wasn't it?
That was really satisfying, just like... The layers of different textures.
It just had a lovely... The layers of plastic and cork and the base of the model was just digging into that. Yeah, yeah. That was really good.
Oh, that was great. That was definitely my favourite.
I'm glad you agree.
I'm glad you're on the same page.
Yeah. that those textures just...
I was like, oh, screw the rest of the spectacle. This is what I'm doing.
Yeah, that was really good.
Yeah, I've written, ooh, they're digging through the packing material. So I like the fact that neither of us have that much to say about Beetlejuice, but both of us consider that.
A highlight, really absolute top-notch stuff there.
I'm glad we're off on the same wavelength, because this is the kind of stuff I say to my students and they're just like completely bewildered. You're like, what are you on about?
No, I mean, that was, yeah.
That was good. I quite like some of the aesthetic. Like, it's got this sort of odd, I guess it's meant to be this sort of 50s Americana tat, perhaps?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I suppose it's similar to what Paranorman does, but I think... I like it a bit more aesthetically than Paranorman because it looks even ropier. Like, Paranorman's pretty slick, whereas this looks kind of run down in a way that's kind of nice, I guess.
I liked the very Schwenkmeyer-esque bit where they stretch out their faces.
Oh, with the eyeball fun. Eyeballs on their fingers.
Yeah, they... they're trying to look scary. It's another one of their attempts to look scary, because they have several failed haunting attempts. And then they just sort of stick their fingers into their faces and stretch them out and distort them. And they have their eyeballs and their fingers and things. That seems to be something that people remember. Because I know my brother about that, and Naki, and they both remembered that part particularly.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
No, I vaguely did. I think it's... I remembered the stop-motion sandworms, which are particularly mm-hmm. kind of jerkily stop-motion animated. And I've seen Beetlejuice in a cinema, and those scenes were particularly enjoyable on a big screen, just because they look kind of so DIY and homebrew, and there's something kind of likeable about those being in, you know, a fairly mainstream film.
Yes, I wrote down that they look like a kind of slightly gory hand puppet.
Just yeah.
The way. And then also that there's a different resemblance to a monster that turns up in Vincent, like the short from Tim Burton's short from 1982, I think.
Yeah.
There's definitely a continuing aesthetic of Burton monsters.
He definitely likes doing that. Like the, I don't know if you remember the duck with the razor sharp teeth on wheels, mm-hmm. you know, in Nightmare Before Christmas. That crops up in his Hansel and Gretel adaptation, which was another kind of early short thing that he did.
Yeah.
I guess just after he was a student for Disney. And that is what lures Hansel and Gretel into the woods.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he definitely likes reusing his little art objects, basically, which is something he shares with Schrankmeyer. Like, you know, if you watch a lot of Jan Schrankmeyer, who's a stop-motion animator we both really like, and if you watch enough of his stuff, you'll see objects crop up again and again, or given little cameos in his different films, and it almost feels like it's part of their kind of private universe, and it's nice as a fan, I guess, because... It means to see you have that kind of shared language of objects on screen.
Mm. What would you say the scariest part of the film was?
Well, it's odd because the first half... I think there were quite a lot of problems from a kind of screenplay perspective for the first half, at least. Mm-hmm. For one thing, it really stretches out the idea that the ghosts aren't able to scare off this new family. And... I just feel like, why don't they start throwing objects around?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I kind of feel like it wouldn't be that hard to do something scary as a ghost, really.
Yeah, they did seem, quite at a loss.
I don't know, maybe I'm more mean-spirited than those nice characters, I don't know. I could scare off people if I had ghost powers pretty quick.
Yeah.
So the first half, a lot of the humour, I guess, comes through bathos, I suppose, or sort of undermining the horror. So you have this kind of, you know, potentially shocking images, which are then immediately undermined by characters being very underwhelmed by them. And I guess that's part of what Burton likes to do, sort of situating horror as being part of the everyday suburban world, and that the real horrors are kind of adult complacency and responsibilities, and actually the ghoulish horrors are kind of treated in quite a sort of down-to-earth, even banal sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you definitely see that in Edward Scissorhands, which followed a few years after this.
Yeah. And Frankenweenie as well.
Which also has that kind of DIY homebrew thing going on. That starts with a film that the kid in the film has made, which seems very similar to the kind of films Burton made as a child. So if you look at his Wikipedia, quite charmingly, on his filmography, it lists the films he directed as a child as well. Like Attack of the 50-Foot Celery Monster.
Yeah.
Did you ever make films as a kid?
I had a friend who I sometimes made little films with. They weren't really anything that fun. They were
filing mostly, executive jobs, a few Excel documents.
Oh, it was kind of... We sort of did this kind of spoof version of Blue Peter, where she was always the presenters, and it was mostly an excuse for her to do a very bad Birmingham accent, because we always did phone-ins.
Okay.
And she always liked to do a really bad Birmingham accent for people on the phone-ins.
What did you get to do?
I was kind of an extra. I got to wear various wigs.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I was, most of the films I made when I was young were just like, I was really fascinated by the elementals of stop motion, that, you know, you could have something in front of the camera, turn off the camera and take it out of shot, and then turn the camera back on and it would look like it just disappeared. So most of the films I made, or a lot of the films I made as a kid, are basically me being like, I'm the amazing magician and I'll make this disappear, and then something disappears. I like to think I'm united in that with, you know, the early cinema pioneers.
So, yeah.
And I did a James Bond spoof too, I just want to say.
Yes.
Called The Disappearing Bond.
I've seen that.
Oh, God, I'm awful. Don't reveal that I force my friends and acquaintances to watch my childhood videos. Probably on a first date as well, you know, like. I have to admit, I did, for documentary, I did bring in some of my own videos to my students and ask them if they could, like, make a film out of them. Yeah. Let's get off my narcissism.
I was asking you about scary things in Beetlejuice.
I don't know, none of it's really scary. Just Beetlejuice is really creepy and off-putting, obviously, but I don't know if that's exactly scary.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be scared if I was, you know, near him in real life, I guess. But
he's very lechy and horrible.
Yeah, I mean, he does make your skin crawl, which I guess is what it's going for.
I'm glad there wasn't actually all that much of him in the film.
Yeah, there isn't. And it's probably, I mean, you know, Michael Keaton gives a pretty committed, zany performance. But, you know, yeah, I'm glad that there was very little of Beetlejuice in Beetlejuice. In many ways, the film shouldn't be named after him, to be honest. It should be called The Useless Ghosts. Or The Ghosts Who Were Nice.
Yeah.
I guess the only real horror for me came from the horror of being deprived of the eternal peace of death. Basically. You know, like,
yeah.
I would be pretty put out if I thought I died, then, oh, okay, and I have to stick around for hundreds of years in the house. Like,
no, it's only 125 years.
God, yeah, and then what? And then they go to some other, then they have to go to a waiting room, some other, I was like, oh, God, just let them die, please. Like, I find it quite funny that the whole, you know, they're brought back in a sort of, the ghosts are kind of summoned near the end in a seance, and then they start shriveling up and becoming desiccated corpses, and the idea is they're sort of dying within their death or something.
Mm.
And I kind of felt like, just let it happen, come on, give them a break.
No. But I think if that happens, then they go to the Lost Souls room.
Oh, good point. And that's just like being conscious but floating in a void or something.
Sort of, yeah, drifting formless and empty in a void forever. And I think that's what's going to happen to them if they keep being keep being exercised.
Where's the void without consciousness? Come on. It's pretty much the only thing that keeps me going. I think, oh, well, you know, at the end of it, you know, it's just like a nice long sleep. You don't even have to get up in the morning. Great.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty horrible. I mean, there's some real horror in the people who have to be the civil servants in the afterlife.
Yeah, that's... And that they all seem quite sort of... I guess the idea is, like real-life civil servants, they all seem quite jaded and bored with their jobs, right?
Yeah.
I quite like the costume of the guy who's been run over, who's like Flat Stanley.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, that was pretty gruesome.
It's very grisly.
Yeah.
But good, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's it. Like, Burton is rarely actually scary because he's quite gleeful about all the kind of ghoulish horribleness. And it's just sort of done in the sort of spirit of, oh, ho, ho, you know, like it's sort of reveling in ghoulishness and slight morbid unpleasantness.
Yeah.
Like,
It took me a while to notice that the caseworker in the afterwork, in the afterlife, Juno, had her throat slit. It's quite subtle.
Yeah. I wasn't sure if it was. I thought it was a tracheotomy.
Okay.
I thought the idea was because she exhales her smoke through that. So I was assuming that the joke, if you will, was that she died of throat cancer from smoking, but she was still smoking even so in the afterlife.
Oh, okay.
I think
maybe
I might be wrong, but that was generally. It does have a few bits like that where you're sort of like not sure if it's sort of going for a joke or not, and yeah, there are moments which are just a bit, I don't, not even troubling, like disquieting maybe, or just a bit like, like, but then it's a 15 rated film, you know, as you say, it's not really a kid's film, but then I can't imagine that many, you know, proper adults sitting down or going to the cinema to watch it. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, did you have any thoughts about the kind of tone of it? I mean, we can get into things that troubled us about the film.
I thought it was kind of, I mean, it makes sense, like, hearing, like, reading a bit about it and hearing that the original script was a lot darker and then it got sort of lightened up. Because it does seem like, that it could have been a lot darker, but it's sort of deliberately keeping it quite light.
Yeah, so originally Beetlejuice has kind of more predatory designs on Winona Ryder's character. So in the film, he does marry her, and this is definitely presented as troubling, but it's shown for expedient reasons that he just wants to do that so he can get some kind of death appeaser or something like that.
Yeah.
Whereas his interests seem to be far more kind of purient and disturbing in the original screenplay, apparently. So I'm glad they got rid of that.
Yes.
And I think, especially as I think for most teenagers, Winona Ryder's character would be the obvious point of identification.
Yeah.
Like, you know, she's the, well, a goth, basically, is her character.
Yeah.
Tim Burton's quite good at writing that kind of character. You know, you get the sense that Burton knew what it was like as a kid not to fit in or to feel kind of different from others. So that stuff in his films always feels fairly convincing to me.
And she's quite like a sort of older female version of Vincent.
Yeah, I suppose she is.
Short. Vincent is, it's like a very short film. It's like a kind of a poem,
it's animation. A student film, I think.
Is it?
Yeah.
He's a boy who wants to be Vincent Price and has various gothic affectations, and his various adults in his life sort of deflate that and say, oh, you're just like, but you're just a little boy. And also in Beetlejuice, Barbara says to Winona Ryder's character, oh, you look like a regular girl to me, after she's got on kind of one of her sort of gothic morbid tangents.
Yeah, she writes a kind of, it's suggested that it's a suicide note, I think. At one point, or sort of at least dark poem. And Winona Ryder has very scrabbly handwriting. I don't know if she was directed to make her handwriting more goth, or if that's actually teenage Winona Ryder's real handwriting. It was quite nice watching, just as having watched Stranger Things, I guess, last year, to see a young Winona Ryder, because there's something slightly like cartoon-like about her. She's, you know, very she's got these very animated sort of darting eyes, and she's so little. I forgot how small she is. But I mean, I think she did better work in Heathers and Edward Scissorhands. But you know, I think as a teenage actor, she's you know, very likeable in this. So I've written as a note, haunted by the absence of people of colour, which is that's my very academic lit theorist way of putting it, I guess.
Yes.
So originally Beetlejuice was going to be played by Sammy Davis Jr. And yeah, coupled with this predatory aspect that was originally in the script, do wonder, if it's sort of exploiting these, well, I say 1980s fears, but obviously rooted in Jim Crow laws, basically, of the black male super predator, basically. And I'm very glad that's written out of the script, obviously, but somehow it's faintly still there, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, we're two white people, so I can't speak expertly about this, but it does feel like there's lingering stuff there that is uncomfortable.
Yeah, there's, in the waiting room, there's a witch doctor character who shrinks people's heads.
The famous scene is they all sing a song by Harry Belafonte.
Yes, they do, yeah.
It's quite odd. I guess the root idea is, not that this makes it defensible, I suppose thematically, the idea is that these are kind of white suburban yuppies, right? And that they've kept her, obviously, really sort of inauthentic, right? Really tasteless. And I think maybe what it's trying to do is that sort of Beetlejuice is originally this sort of site of racial anxiety, right? And then he sort of is changed in the revised script to being more about class anxiety, I'd say. That it's more like, you know, he's the sort of uncouth southern hillbilly stereotype, basically. So, you know, a lot of Burton's films, I guess, are about white suburbia and its contamination fears. And so you could at a stretch say, oh, it's trying to be subversive, but I guess it kind of feels like it's faintly there, but not enough is done with it in any kind of interrogative way. It's just there and it's uncomfortable.
I don't think it really feels like it's particularly being challenged, or
not really
in any very thorough way.
And it feels a bit odd to use. I mean, Harry Belafonte's music is fun, but I guess to use it just as this source of fun, I don't know. I feel it kind of really depoliticizes Belafonte, who is obviously a very politically radical figure, and using him in a kind of mainstream Hollywood film just for a kind of set piece, I don't know. I'd say it might be that, you know, Burton has in more recent years being called out for the kind of pervasive whiteness of his films.
Yeah, I imagine so. And this one is 1988, so it is a while ago now. I don't know if he's changed. I haven't really watched many Burton films in recent years, well, to be honest.
It'll be very interesting. Well, I say interesting. I think for some people who are less privileged, it's probably not going to be interesting. It's going to be upsetting and infuriating, potentially, to see what he does with Dumbo. Because he's doing the live action. Yeah, he's doing the live action remake of Dumbo. Yeah, and obviously Dumbo has, as most Disney, early Disney films do, certainly, a lot of racist elements.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's going to have to tread lightly, frankly. Hopefully he'll be able to and, you know, create something good. But we'll see.
Yeah. You want to talk about Frank and Weenie a bit?
Yeah, I mean,
I mostly want to talk about it because it has Shelley Duvall in it.
You just really love Shelley Duvall.
I do. Oh, I didn't know she was in it, and then I was so happy. Yeah, I didn't know she was in it, and then she turned up, and I squealed with delight.
did you literally squeal with delight?
I did. Most of my notes are just doodles of Shelley Duvall's face. Some of them with hearts.
Oh, you have to stand up. I want to see you.
Oh, yeah, lovely Shelley Duvall.
did you want to say any more on that, or is that...
I don't know. I mean, I'm probably... Probably my Shining rant isn't really relevant.
not strictly. I mean,
basically, I hate The Shining because it's really mean to Shelley Duvall, and she looks upset for the whole film. And
was, I think.
And also, now we learned, also had a horrible time filming it. And I think that the way it's filmed sort of makes it seems like it sides with the abuser, and it felt really horrible and wrong to me.
Yeah, I think that's a really fair critique of Kubrick. I mean, I do think, I guess thematically, his stuff's about the allure of power, but you do feel like there's a lot of giving the audience vicarious pleasure through occupying the perspective of abusive, sadistic men. Like, the same thing totally happens in Clockwork Orange, which I really dislike. Like, I like bits of The Shining because it's got some fun set pieces and, you know, it's got cool tracking shots. So, you know, there's part of me that, like, but Clockwork Orange, I find totally intolerable. I really hate that film because it just feels really nasty. And, yeah, I think that he kind of, his films sort of, they feel very anti-human to me. they kind of, and yeah, you could say that's what he's doing, but yeah. It does, you know, like, so I've known so many guys who say that Kubrick's their favourite director, and yeah, it does trouble me a bit.
Yeah. I wondered if, you know, because in Beetlejuice, the Maitlands drown because, they veer off the bridge because they're trying not to hit a dog, and then they're sort of teetering on the edge of falling into the river, and the dog's on the other end of the seesaw, and then casually hops off, and they fall into the river and drown. I wondered if that was the sort of balancing because a dog gets killed in Beetlejuice.
So do you you feel that the dog was taking revenge in a sense?
Yes. Not the same dog, but
okay,
dogs.
The dogs were trying to write the filmic balance. Although, of course, you know, as revenge often goes, it goes too far, right? The murder dog kills kills two humans, whereas only one dog. I mean, I guess you could say that Sparky in Frankenweenie is killed twice, in a sense. But, you know, how many people have to die to make up for all good dogs go to heaven? Actually, it is all dogs go to heaven. I think I stipulated good dogs because I don't really like dogs. Right. I can recognise Frankenweenie's quite a charming little film, but I don't like dogs. God, I probably should have said, God, I've just lost like half our subscribers at this point. I like cats.
I don't really like dogs cats either. Cats, oh God. Oh.
You like the cats internet people, right? There were shrimp hands, that was good.
Like the shrimp hands.
And right. Oh, and the dead teenage footballers were pretty cute.
Yeah.
Has some kind of ditzy footballers who don't seem to understand they're dead, and they randomly appear at the end to dance alongside Winona Ryder's character. No reason whatsoever.
There was a really horrible spider at the beginning. It was much too big.
Well, he does.
Alec Baldwin picks it up in his hands,
He does say, "Oh, you're big," or something to it.
Yeah.
I mean, were you not happy about it from a kind of workers' rights, labour union perspective?
Yeah, like.
Oh, I've got to get the actors' union into this.
I'm not happy that he had to pick up a spider with his bare hands that was that large. And he's very unhappy with his performance in this film.
Really?
But apparently he's not keen, but maybe it's because he was just so put off by having to touch such a horrible spider.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Maybe he just kept thinking about it.
You know the dog in Frankenweenie is called Sparky?
Yes, yeah.
Is that where dog like Sparky comes from?
It's a good question, but I don't think it is. I swear that I've read something else. So, I mean, we're getting into obscure references again. I mean, you know, we could put a link to Dog Like Sparky because people
should listen to it. It's a song by a band called The Cardiacs that me and Adam are very, very keen on.
Yeah, they're worthy of laudation.
They are worthy of laudation.
But yeah, I don't know if there's so much more to say, because Burton, I mean, I guess some of those later films, teenagers would watch them, but they're not quite within the remit of kids' horror. Like, Sleepy Hollow films, like, it's more geared towards adults, I'd say. Edward Scissorhands, again, I mean, Edward Scissorhands is, I don't know, is it, again, it's, I mean, I wouldn't be unhappy about children watching Edward Scissorhands, I suppose. It gets, the death, the main antagonist is surprisingly kind of violent, I remember. But I think on rewatching Beetlejuice, I prefer Edward Scissorhands. Which is a bit more kind of heartfelt and sweet and has a bit more of a plot, basically. And this is unusual. You know, I like films where the stuff happens, but Beetlejuice does feel a little bit scattered to me. That really it's the set design that's gelling it together.
I mean, it's that digging scene with the astroturf and the cork and the...
Yeah, I mean, that's...
That is the heart of the film.
To be honest, that could be a short film. And, you know, I'd probably give it, like, 10 out of 10 stars.
Yeah. Good.
it, it's a hot take.
Yeah.
I'll make a BuzzFeed list. The 25 reasons why the AstroTurf digging scene is the best sequence in 80s cinema. You'll be shocked when you find out why.
Just the textures. Oh, they're so good.
The list will just be textures. In increasingly large fonts.
Good.
Good. So,
we're
back onto more regular kids' horror fare with William Sleater.
Yes, I mean, my copy of Interstellar Pig has arrived, and I'll talk about the cover, obviously, in the next episode, but it is wonderful, so.
I mean, you know, get ready, folks, because this is a largely forgotten book about an evil alien board game.
Yes!
Yeah.
All right. Do you have a sign-off?
I don't have a sign. Just don't be like Beetlejuice. That's my sign-off.
Yeah. Keep it spooky, but don't be creepy.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. Our intro music's by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music's by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. And I'll put all of that info in the show notes, along with the transcript. See you next time.
Bye.